You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On April 9th, 2015, Rick Britton presented the third lecture in our six-part CPN Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. In this podcast, you'll learn about the role that Monticello played in the American Civil War. At the commencement of the war, Monticello was a property of Uriah Phillips Levy, who had purchased it in 1834. Listen as Rick tells the story of how Monticello's ownership changed hands several times as the war progressed. Rick Britton is an historian of the Old Dominion who specializes in 18th and 19th century Virginia history. Two of his main areas of expertise are the American Civil War and the life and times of our third president, Thomas Jefferson. Along with his writing, Rick conducts tours of Civil War battlefields, teaches classes on the history of Central Virginia, organizes history programming for the Senior Center in Charlottesville, illustrates maps for history books, and lectures all across Virginia on a wide range of topics. With over 200 published articles and essays under his belt, he's the author of Albemarle and Charlottesville, an Illustrated History, and Jefferson, a Monticello Sampler, for which he was awarded a medal for nonfiction at New York City Books Expo, the nation's largest book convention. His newest book, Virginia Vignettes, Volume 1, Famous Characters and Events from Central Virginia History, is the first of a new series featuring some of the men and women that figure large in 18th and 19th century American history. The lecture was presented by Rick Britton as a part of this series and was held in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled Monticello in the Civil War. Here's Rick Britton.
So tonight's talk is Monticello in the Civil War. The date was April 3rd, 1860. The place, St. Joseph, Missouri. The large crowd had assembled early in the afternoon to witness the momentous occasion scheduled for 5 p.m. Under broad-brimmed hats, they stood outside the flag and bunting-covered railroad station debating just how the event was going to change their lives. Standing at the front of the large crowd was the express company's general superintendent. Tall, thin, and rugged-looking, he was, at that particular moment, especially preoccupied with his pocket watch. As the appointed hour approached and passed, his mood deteriorated from frustration to anger. Then came word that the train from Hannibal, Missouri, would be delayed by as much as 2 hours. His schedule was utterly ruined. When the train finally pulled in, and unfortunately the accounts differ as to the exact time, the mail from the East Coast was taken off, locked into a specially designed saddlebag, and thrown over top a saddle strapped to a feisty bay mare. Onto the horse vaulted Johnson William Richardson, a small sailor with many years' experience, claimed the St. Joseph Weekly West amid the snow and icebergs of the Northern Ocean. As the shouting rose to a crescendo, the superintendent approached his rider and tossed him a 25-cent coin. "What's this for?" asked the startled Richardson. "That's for you to buy a rope," growled the impatient superintendent, "and hang yourself if you don't make the correct time." A shout, a slap to the horse's flank, and the first Pony Express rider was off. By now, probably most of you are wondering, what in the world does this have to do with Monticello in the Civil War? Right? The answer is quite simple. It crossed your mind, right? That general superintendent of the Pony Express was Benjamin Franklin Ficklin, an Albemarle County man who founded the Pony Express, operated blockade runners for the Confederacy, and briefly owned Monticello at the end of the American Civil War. Largely forgotten by history, Ficklin, I believe, is the most fascinating of Monticello's owners in the period after Jefferson's death. At the end of this talk, let me know and tell me if you agree. As you can well imagine, the Civil War was an extremely difficult time for Monticello. Fast approaching ruin, the house that Jefferson built was visited by armed men on both sides of the conflict, as well as a constant stream of relic-hunting civilians. It suffered through an auction, the second auction for Monticello, and changed hands. What's worse, it appears that during this period, very little, if anything, was done to prevent the structure's further deterioration. Monticello's Civil War accounts are few, but fortunately they're pretty darn interesting. At the commencement of the Civil War, Monticello, of course, was the property of Uriah Phillips Levy, who had purchased it in 1834. Around the same time, Levy also bought Washington Farm, a 961-acre estate that bordered Buckeye Land Creek and was just across the Milton Road from James Monroe's former Highland property. So in other words, just down the road from Monticello, he bought another 961 acres. An admirer of Jefferson's stance on religious freedom, Levy had become the first Jewish commodore in the United States Navy. In the Navy, he was known for his courageous service in the War of 1812, his fight for the abolition of flogging, that's pretty important, the use, in other words, of cat o' nine tails as a form of punishment, and for how he consistently stood up against and overcame the Navy's rampant anti-Semitic climate. Born in Philadelphia in 1792, Levy's permanent home was in New York City. For that reason, he was never more than a part-time resident of Monticello. He used Monticello instead as a vacation home and moved his widow mother, Rachel Levy, to the Little Mountain in 1837. She became the steward of the estate until her death in 1839. In 1861, Levy's Monticello manager was Joel N. Wheeler, who over the previous two decades had worked in a similar capacity for one of Jefferson's grandsons, Dr. Benjamin Randolph. Wheeler, in the fall of 1860, had taken over at Monticello from Ira Chapman Garrison. Visitor accounts have given us the impression that Jefferson's essay in architecture during this period was virtually abandoned, a once dignified classical ruin standing alone on the Little Mountain. This perception, however, is inaccurate. During the Civil War years, perhaps as many as 50 individuals resided permanently at Levy's two Albemarle County properties, Monticello and Washington Farm. These included Wheeler and his wife Martha, Wheeler's nephew, Joel Jefferson Wheeler, fortunate middle name there, Joel N. Wheeler's adopted son, James N. Bailey, Bailey's uncle Richard, so the whole family's coming, and his wife, the previous caretaker, so he's no longer the caretaker, but Garrison stays, that was Garrison, and his brother Ralph's family, and possibly as many as 40 enslaved African Americans, half of them owned by Northerner Levy, the other half by Wheeler. Uriah P. Levy's active service had ended on July 14, 1860, when he sailed the Macedonian into the Navy Yard at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. 2 days later, he was detached from the ship and granted 3 months' leave. He and his young wife spent the remainder of that summer, the summer of 1860, right here at Monticello. And it was a really young wife. I think she's 40, 45 years younger than Levy. Following the firing on Fort Sumter in April of 1861, the 69-year-old Levy repeatedly asked to be part of the Union war effort. The story that the frustrated naval officer somehow gained an audience with Abraham Lincoln at the White House, an audience during which Levy supposedly pleaded for a command, this story is most likely apocryphal, not true. When an assignment finally arrived in November of 1861, it was for Levy to take charge of the Navy's court-martial board in Washington, D.C., an interesting post considering the number of times Levy himself had faced a court-martial. So that's what you do. You get somebody with experience. He was up for court-martial a number of times, so he's been in that court. So put him in charge of that court. That's how the government works. Serving in the federal capital for 4 months, Levy returned to New York City due to illness and died of pneumonia at his home at 107 St. Mark's Place on March 22, 1862. Levy's passing, as y'all can imagine, was a huge blow to Monticello. As we'll see shortly, the Confederacy already had Jefferson's estate in its sights. But Levy's will, a bizarre document, and wait till you hear about this document, a bizarre document to say the least, would keep the Commodore's heirs in a legal uproar until 1879. Monticello's fate, meanwhile, hung in the balance. Drafted in 1858, Levy's will left the Monticello estate, plus much New York City real estate, so the two are tied together in this will, to the people of the United States for the purpose of establishing at Monticello an agricultural school for the education of the orphans of warrant officers of the United States Navy. Failing that, Monticello would go to the state of Virginia for the same purpose. So in other words, if the people of the United States won't take it, I'm leaving it to the state of Virginia. Failing that, and one gets the impression that Levy sensed that these propositions would fail, failing that, Jefferson's mansion was to go to the Portuguese Hebrew congregations of New York, Philadelphia, and Richmond to be used as an agricultural school for orphans. Because the Commodore's heirs contested the will, the odd document bounced around the halls of Congress and various courts until it was declared invalid in April of 1863 by the New York Supreme Court. By that time, however, another very large interested party had joined the fray. Enter the Confederate States of America. In order to protect itself from the many loyal Northerners living in the South, and there were many, the Confederate Congress passed in August of 1861 the Alien Enemies Act and the related Sequestration Act. These two rather amazing laws called for the removal of all staunch Northerners from the Confederacy. Send them back up north. And that's not enough. Send them back up north. And the seizure and sale of all of their property. Interestingly, and I find this pretty amazing, interestingly, blatantly ironic is the fact that many Southerners considered Jefferson one of the fathers of the states' rights doctrine based on his close involvement with the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions of 1799, documents surreptitiously written to counter the hateful Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 passed by the John Adams administration. The similarity between the Alien Enemies Acts and the Alien and Sedition Acts is striking. So here are people who consider Jefferson one of the fathers of states' rights doctrine based on him writing the Kentucky Resolution of 1799, basically saying that if the federal government passes a law that we don't like, we don't have to follow it. States' rights doctrine. That belongs to the state, not to the federal government. And yet, they believe that Jefferson is the father of one of the fathers of states' rights, and yet they pass something that's very similar to the hateful act that Jefferson wrote the Kentucky Resolution to counter. The Richmond Examiner announced on October 11, 1861, that, quote, "The home of Thomas Jefferson will soon pass into the possession and ownership of the Confederate States government. Proceedings were begun yesterday to sequestrate Monticello as the property of an alien enemy. The people of Charlottesville called the late owner of Monticello, Commodore Levy." Although Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper, a New York City publication, reported in February of 62 that Monticello was seized, quote, "with all its lands, Negroes, cattle, farming utensils, furniture, paintings, wines, etc., valued at between $70,000 and $80,000, this was confiscation in name only. Farm manager Joel Wheeler, a union man who by this time had moved his family into the big house, into Jefferson's home, and George Carr, Esquire, Levy's Charlottesville lawyer and an executor of his estate, tried to stop the seizure and sale of the property. When this eventually failed, Monticello was put on the auction block on November 17th, 1864. By 1864, the house, grounds, and family cemetery were in an awful state. For some reason, visitors have always gravitated to Monticello's dome room. That's why I think Monticello has made a mistake of putting the dome room on a regular tour nowadays, because people always like think it's special to go up to the dome room. It is pretty special, but it's not going to be special after everybody's been there four or five times. Almost unused in Jefferson's day, it now boasted more than 1,000 of their names written on its walls. And while they left their signatures bold or hesitant, many took away something else. Year by year, they chipped and chiseled away at Jefferson's tombstone. Miss Ada White Backhot, it's a really strange last name, Backhot, a volunteer nurse from a well-to-do South Carolina family, described it in this way in her diary entry for March 18, 1862. Quote, "Soon we found ourselves near the enclosure containing the tomb of Jefferson. We got out of the carriage and walked up to it. A more neglected, desolate place one could not imagine. The tomb, misspelled, which is of common brown stone, spiral in form." Y'all have seen the newer version, which is an obelisk. The newer version is a larger version of the original. What would make it look spiral? People had chipped away all the edges. All the corners, people had chipped away. Spiral in form is mutilated and defaced, I guess so, in every possible way. I picked up a few fragments which had been chipped off by some rude hand. In other words, she didn't chip them off. But she picked them up, somebody else did, conveniently, right? We then walked up to the house by a rugged path. Mrs. Wheeler soon opened the door for us, and we walked in. A few portraits and engravings were strung around, and the clock, whose immense weights hang down on either side, telling the day of the week. Nearby sat an antique table with a war club. There was also another weapon composed of wood and sword fish teeth. Very curious. We each begged a tooth, which the old lady granted. Right. Later on, while her party picnicked on the lawn, the gentleman went back into the house looking for more relics. They soon presented Nurse Backhot with a shoelace, a cup, and a piece of one of the old mahogany chairs belonging to Thomas Jefferson, the Windsor chairs that sat in the entrance hall. Another volunteer nurse from South Carolina, Miss Clark from Mansville, reported in her diary that her and her companion, a Dr. Parker from Mississippi, saw Jefferson's own bed. So here's a doctor and a nurse going through the house. Presumably they're fairly well educated, right? Doctor and a nurse. And even though they thought the alcove was a novel idea, they just had to get a chip of it and several other relics before they left the house. They also scribbled their names on the wall. The nurses were in Charlottesville to attend to the hundreds of sick and wounded soldiers at the Charlottesville General Hospital, the vast Confederate hospital complex established in the town following the Battle of First Manassas. Over the course of the war, of course, something like 22,000 sick and wounded soldiers were treated at the Charlottesville General Hospital. Monticello, when the hospital first came to be, was suggested as the perfect location for a smallpox ward. Luckily, this proposal was never acted upon. Many officers and soldiers were in Charlottesville in the fall of 1863, recovering from their wounds, wrote Louise Wigfall Wright in her book entitled A Southern Girl in 1861. So picnics were organized to historic Monticello. Quote, "One day we had a tournament on the grounds. The participants, dressed in rather nondescript costumes, were mounted on sorry-looking nags." She wrote that some of the knights, with only one arm to use, holding the reins in the teeth and dashing valiantly at the rings with wooden sticks improvised as spears for the occasion. So something that was really popular all across the South was these medieval tournaments. And this had been going on for a while. What better proof can be found? Oh, yeah, here I made a mention of it. What better proof can be found for the fact that the antebellum South's favorite novelist was Sir Walter Scott? And, of course, Sir Walter Scott's most famous novel was Ivanhoe, right? Ivanhoe. I don't know if UVA student Clinton Kleinbell was a Scott devotee, but he certainly had literary aspirations, and he found a few interesting items in Jefferson's home during his wartime visit. Quote, "Stilling the burning emotions of indignation and regret, which I felt at seeing this sacred relic thus sinking into ruin, I approached the steps," he wrote. In the hall, Kleinbell saw an Indian war club and a spear, along with a few pictures and portraits that were, quote unquote, very much damaged. Then, as he was about to depart, the little boy who had accompanied him, quote, opened one of the drawers of an ancient desk and showed me some old books and torn pictures, among which I accidentally found a small piece of parchment. It was a note written in French, signed Lafayette. Kleinbell didn't mention whether or not he pilfered it, but I assume that he probably did. Can you imagine that, walking off with Lafayette's signature? Perhaps not surprisingly, some of the most respectful Civil War visitors were those in uniform. When members of John Bell Hood's Texas Brigade came a-calling in June of 1862, a number of them paused reverently on Jefferson's East Portico, one of his sacred portals, they called it, and mused about the famous statesman and his glorious memories. A crowd from the 3rd South Carolina Volunteers went all through the house, making note of Jefferson's gig. Y'all know what a gig is, right? His riding carriage. They had actually, by this time, moved it into the house, and it sat in one of the bedrooms. Making note of Jefferson's gig and the curiously constructed clock. Of course, the clock in the great plantation clock in the entrance hall. At the cemetery, unit member Richard W. Simpson found his thoughts running back to the trying times of 76, when our ancestors were nobly striving for independence. What would Jefferson say, he wrote. Could he return once more to his native land and see the country swept over by the ravages of war? What would Jefferson say? Great question, especially considering the fact that Jefferson's own family and Monticello's extended family were divided over the war's momentous issues, just like the nation. I guess it's not surprising. Ellen Randolph Coolidge, one of Jefferson's granddaughters, who, after her marriage to Joseph Coolidge, moved to Boston, had two sons in the Union Army. One of them, Sidney Coolidge, was killed at the Battle of Chickamauga, Georgia, in 1864. Several relatives and descendants of Monticello's enslaved community also served in the Union Army. These men included James M. Trotter and William Dupree, both of whom married great-great-granddaughters of Elizabeth Hemings of Monticello. So that means they are great-granddaughters of Sally Hemings. They're married to great-granddaughters of Sally Hemings. So they're related to Jefferson by marriage. The third, John Freeman Shorter, was her great-great-grandson. Coincidentally, and I thought this was amazing, all three fought in the 55th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry. That's a sister unit to the famous 54th Massachusetts that they made the movie Glory about. And these three men were the unit's only fully commissioned African-American officers. That was very rare, eventually serving as lieutenants. Normally, the war's black regiments were officered only by white men, normally. At first denied higher rank, these gentlemen fought the Union Army prejudice. Trotter even penned a letter to William Lloyd Garrison himself, saying that this half-and-half arrangement is very unpleasant to us. And most all the line officers, they just give us the cold shoulder, so the white officers wouldn't pay any attention to them. Trotter and Shorter also fought the Army's unequal pay for black soldiers. The 55th Massachusetts saw action in the disastrous Union defeat at Honey Hill, South Carolina, on November 30th, 1864, where Trotter and Shorter were both wounded. Traveling home to Ohio to get married at the end of the war, Shorter died of smallpox soon after arriving. Can you imagine? You survive the war, you make it home, and you die there of smallpox. On the Confederate side of the ledger, Lieutenant Colonel Bennett Taylor of the 19th Virginia Infantry was the son of John C.R. Taylor and Patsy Jefferson Randolph. Patsy was the daughter of Thomas Jefferson Randolph of Edge Hill and his wife, Jane Collins Nicholas. Trained as a lawyer, Taylor volunteered in June of 1861. 2 years later, he was made Lieutenant Colonel of the 19th Virginia Infantry. In that capacity, he participated in the horrific Gettysburg assault known as Pickett's Charge, where he was so badly wounded that the family feared for the worst. Captured at the end of the attack, Taylor was treated at a Chester, Pennsylvania hospital, then spent almost 2 years as a prisoner of war on Johnson's Island, not one of the best places to be. After the war, Taylor worked for a few years as co-editor of the Charlottesville Chronicle, the newspaper of record of Charlottesville. He died in 1898 and was buried in Monticello Cemetery on the Little Mountain. Your Sam Towler wrote that Lewis Harvey, a free black man married to Amanda Coleman and evidently living at Monticello, volunteered for service in the Confederate Army in 1861. So Sam wrote of a black man who volunteered. If this is true, there were two possible results. One, he was turned down because blacks were not allowed to serve in the ranks until March of 1865. Or two, if he was accepted, it was as a wagoner or as a laborer. Towler also wrote that Lewis Randolph, son of Dr. Benjamin Randolph, volunteered at the outbreak of the war. And that's not all that unusual. There are lots of stories of blacks offering their service to the Confederacy at the beginning of the war. Amazing as that sounds, it did happen. Whether they were accepted is another thing. Free blacks, yep. The highest ranking and the most famous Confederate descendant of Thomas Jefferson, however, of course, was George With Randolph, Jefferson's youngest grandson. In one of, I don't know if you've been in the house, how many of y'all have been in the house? Everybody's been in the house. You go into the Madison room, Mr. Madison's room, and on the, you come through the door, and on the right-hand wall right here are two paintings by Jane Petticolis of Richmond. The one that's on the top shows three of the grandchildren on the west lawn, and a little boy in a white top hat is rolling a hoop on the west lawn. That's George With Randolph. Born on the Little Mountain in 1818, Randolph served in the Navy, attended UVA, then hung out his law practice shingle near Charlottesville. In 1850, he moved to Richmond. In 1861, he served as a delegate to the state secession convention, where he voted in favor of Virginia leaving the Union so cherished by his grandfather. Having organized the famous Richmond Howitzers, a volunteer militia artillery company, Randolph was promoted to the rank of major when that unit was enlarged to battalion size. As major, he commanded General John Bankhead Magruder's artillery at the Civil War's first land battle of any significance, the Battle of Big Bethel, fought on June 10, 1861, on the Virginia Peninsula. Randolph's Richmond Howitzers actually opened the fight, firing the first salvo when Union forces came into range. Major Randolph estimated the distance at 600 yards and later proudly claimed, I've read his after-action report, proudly claimed credit for aiming the cannon that had fired the first shot. The bolt from the 10-pounder Parrott, he wrote, quote, struck the center of the road a short distance in front of their column and probably did good execution in its ricochet. Colonel D.H. Hill, who later rose to the rank of lieutenant general, remarked that Randolph's opening shot had completely broken up the initial federal advance. Promotion came quickly to colonel, then to brigadier general in February of 1862. On March 17, 1862, Randolph was made Confederate States Secretary of War. And here is something that's so odd. In this position, of course, he served in the cabinet of a man named after his own grandfather. Neat, huh? Doesn't happen all that often. Think about it. It's interesting to note two things relative to Randolph's rise to prominence in the Confederacy. One, it coincided with the CSA's growing interest in seizing Monticello. Did he have a hand in this? And I've looked through the documents. I'm pretty sure he did, but I can't find proof that he did. And two, this may be obvious, but it merits mentioning. Many Confederates thought of the Civil War as the Second War for Independence. By placing Randolph in his cabinet, Jeff Davis gained a direct connection to the American Revolution, right? As Secretary of War, Randolph pushed a conscription bill through the Confederate Congress, thus perhaps assuring that the war lasts longer. So he was one of the guys pushing conscription, the draft, and helped organize the Western Theater into a more centralized and successful departmental system. When, after only 8 months in office, he finally became completely exasperated with Jefferson Davis's constant meddling and micromanaging, everybody did eventually. The man could not stay out of everybody else's business. Randolph resigned to return to his law practice. He later moved his family to Europe, but returned after the war and died in Charlottesville in 1867. He was buried, like Taylor, in the Monticello Family Cemetery. During the Civil War, even the Levy family suffered from divided loyalties. Commodore Levy was a Union man, of course, but his younger brother, Jonas Phillips Levy, went over to the Confederacy. According to Mark Leibson, Jonas, in an unpublished memoir, wrote that he was in Washington in 1861 with his wife and his four young children until he left without them, headed for Mexico, following the Union takeover of Baltimore. If Mexico was really his destination, he didn't get all that far. By August of that year, he was at Monticello, stirring up trouble. Several sources even claim that Jonas Levy took up residence at Monticello. So he leaves his family in the north, he comes down here, and he starts living at Monticello. Soon after arriving, Jonas raised a Confederate flag atop Monticello. When pro-Union man Joel Wheeler pulled it down, Levy wrote to then-Secretary of War Judah P. Benjamin, who was also Jewish, telling him about the incident. This guy's stirring up all kinds of trouble down here at Monticello. That month, Levy, who had captained the USS America in the Mexican War and had served in the Peruvian Navy, also wrote to Benjamin and President Jefferson Davis with two naval proposals. Why send off one proposal if you can send off two in the same letter, right? Why go small? Dream big, right? He offered to build in Europe a 20-gun ironclad, and he offered to organize for the Confederacy a blockade-running operation. The real reason for his appearance at Monticello, however, was exposed 8 months later when he petitioned a Confederate Congress asking for a slight modification of the sequestration law that would allow him, as a loyal citizen of the Confederacy, to inherit Monticello. There's the reason behind all of this. Let me have Monticello. This petition was rejected by the Confederate Congress. Sometime over the next few years, Jonas Levy drifted to Wilmington, North Carolina, where he opened a hardware and chandlery business. On November 17, 1864, however, Jonas Phillips Levy was back at Monticello, along with a large crowd for the public auction. After the deputy marshal had proclaimed the decree and the terms of the sale, according to the New York Times, based on the account in the Lynchburg paper, Captain Levy, and that's this Jonas Levy, stated that he did not come here to interfere with the sale in any way, and that he intended to bid for the property himself. So he really, really wants Monticello. The deputy marshal then stated that 1 acre of the place, the cemetery of Thomas Jefferson, was reserved in the sale. In other words, that's not a part of the sale, the family cemetery. And Captain Levy said he added that his mother was also interred on the property, and he hoped whoever became the purchaser would let her rest in peace. Perhaps it was possible to find peace at Monticello in 1864, but the house and grounds were in a miserable state. Visitors have defaced the walls of the house by scribbling their names over them, wrote the Lynchburg reporter. Pieces of the bust of Mr. Jefferson were chipped off. Who would chip off parts of a bust, right? Chairs, tables, mirrors, vases, broken and destroyed, and in some cases, mementos of rare virtue and art have been purloined. And the monument of the immortal Jefferson has been sadly defaced, and the fragments carried off as trophies or mementos from a sacred shrine. Shame, shame upon our thoughtless countrymen. Why would they be so disrespectful? All of that from the Lynchburg newspaper. And the worst, though, was yet to come, the auction itself. Monticello and its remaining 218 acres, with all buildings thereon consisting of a large, commodious brick dwelling house, that's Monticello itself, large, commodious brick dwelling house, with a variety of outbuildings, was put up on the block first. Next, Washington Farm, all 961 acres, went to J.H. Parker at $88 per acre. Those were the days, right? $88 an acre. Wow. Then, noted the New York Times, came the slaves at auction. The first Negro man, Fuke, brought $7,000. That shows you the inflation in the Confederacy by end of 1864. The next, Fleming, $7,450. Lewis, $7,350. John was sold to Captain Levy for $5,400. Objects from inside the house were sold next. According to the Times, the bust of Mr. Jefferson, which stood in the hall on a fluted Corinthian pedestal, brought only $50. So people were there for the slaves, but not the classical bust of Mr. Jefferson. The pianoforte brought $5,000. Sideboard with marble top, $510. Model of the United States frigate Vandalia, which Uriah Levy had commanded in 38 and 39, was bought by J.P. Levy, his brother, for $100. And a threshing machine, Jefferson experimented with his threshing machine, went for $600. The bust of Voltaire was sold, and it was said to have been Mr. Jefferson's. The total amount brought in by the auction was $350,000. Confederate dollars, that is. CSA currency at the time, when in Richmond it took a wheelbarrow full of money to buy a wheelbarrow full of potatoes. That's how bad the inflation was in wartime Richmond. Naturally, Monticello itself brought in the biggest chunk of the $350,000. When the house was put up, the first bid was $20,000. The last was $80,500. That's a winning bid. $80,500, and that was the bid of Benjamin Franklin Ficklin. Born in Albemarle County in December of 27, Ficklin was the son of Reverend Benjamin Ficklin, a well-to-do property owner and magistrate who also operated a Charlottesville dry goods store. Ben's older brother, Slaughter Ficklin, was a partner in Farish Ficklin & Company, a stagecoach enterprise that also delivered the U.S. mail. In 44, Ficklin began attending the VMI in Lexington. His marks were low, but his pranks were legendary. He once, for example, painted the superintendent's horse with zebra-like red stripes. After another nighttime prank involving a 10-pounder howitzer and lots of broken glass, Ben was dismissed and unceremoniously sent back home to Albemarle County. He later wheedled himself back into VMI, claiming with more than a bit of exaggeration that he had since fought in the Mexican War and had been left for dead on the field of battle. He graduated fourth from the bottom on July 4, 1849. Ben Ficklin taught school for a brief period, but the lure of the West was too great. By the early 1850s, he was out on the Western Plains in the employ of the Russell, Majors, and Waddell Freight Line. Ficklin learned quite a bit as a route agent for this firm. During the Mormon War in the late 1850s, Ficklin served with the United States Army as a courier and a scout. By 1860, Ben Ficklin was working as a route superintendent for the massive, and this is so difficult to pronounce, Central Overland California and Pikes Peak Express Company. The Pony Express was undertaken as part of this company's huge operation. Historians of the West maintain that it was Ficklin, in fact, from Albemarle County, who first hatched the audacious idea. Under Superintendent Ficklin's management, the 2,000-mile route connecting St. Joseph, Missouri and Sacramento, California crossed treacherous mountain terrain and sun-baked desert sands. It also ran right through Indian country. Remaining with the Pony Express for only 3 months, Ficklin once again followed the call of adventure. The Civil War had broken out. Back in his native state in May of 1861, he was commissioned major and appointed temporary quartermaster general of Virginia's Provisional Army. And that meant, of course, that the man who he reported directly to was named Robert Edward Lee. Not content behind a desk, however, Ficklin became an overseas purchasing agent, buying up various supplies for the Confederacy in Europe. Lured by adventure on the high seas, Ficklin also became a blockade runner, operating three ships in that very risky business, the Virginia, the Coquette, and the Giraffe. The ocean-going operation must certainly have netted him lots of cash, as this business was probably the source of his Monticello-winning bid of $80,500. Ficklin's reasons for purchasing Monticello are not known for certain, but a Harper's Weekly news piece stated that he eventually wanted to present the property to the state of Virginia. It's also interesting to note that at that time, the time of the auction, his brother, Slaughter Ficklin, was the proprietor of the nearby, Belmont Plantation. In November of 1864, then, Ficklin was Monticello's new owner. But it wasn't until March 17, 1865, a mere 3 weeks prior to General Robert E. Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse, that he actually acquired title to the property. By that time, the house had experienced an uptick in visitation. Following the destruction of Confederate forces in the Shenandoah Valley, Union Major General Philip Sheridan led a cavalry army of 10,000 horsemen over the Blue Ridge Mountains into Albemarle County. Charlottesville was captured on March 3, 1865. The following day, a large number of Yankee riders swarmed, that's the word they used, around Monticello, like bees. Joel Wheeler later stated that there were squads of soldiers, perhaps 25. Richard Bailey said there were maybe 100. Wheeler opened the smokehouse and the stables for them and claimed, when he applied for compensation to the federal government in the 1880s, that they took two horses, rye, wheat, and pork. The federal government eventually allotted Wheeler, a pro-Union man, $540, one-third of the loss that he reported. With Sheridan's men out of the way, Ficklin was briefly able to enjoy his ownership of the Little Mountain. Although it's unclear whether he ever stayed in Jefferson's home, Ficklin family lore holds that one of Ben's brothers, Willie, sold furniture from Monticello to pay his gambling debts. Quite a family, and that Ben's elderly father died at Monticello. One writer recently dug up a newspaper obituary for the Reverend that backs up this later claim. Not only did he die at Monticello, but died in Jefferson's bed at Monticello. In April of 1865, Ben Ficklin was in Washington, D.C. on the 16th of the month, 2 days after Abraham Lincoln was shot. Ficklin was arrested on the suspicion of his involvement in the Lincoln assassination. An alert and overly nervous telegraph operator had reported him to the authorities, claiming that the 38-year-old presented, quote, the appearance of a refined pirate. Ficklin was released after spending a couple of months in prison. Within 2 years, he was back out west running the U.S. mail between San Antonio and El Paso. Ben Ficklin died in 1871 and was buried back home in Charlottesville's Maplewood Cemetery. He's actually my favorite resident of Maplewood Cemetery downtown. Ficklin was gone, and the Civil War in 1871 was 6 years in the past. But Monticello's legal woes were still ongoing. When the Civil War ended, of course, the Confederacy's seizure and sale of Monticello became null and void. The property reverted to the estate of Uriah Phillips Levy, and the potential heirs of the estate continued squabbling. In March of 1879, Monticello once again went under the gavel. The new owner was Jefferson Monroe Levy. What a name, huh? Son of the pro-Confederate Jonas Levy and nephew of Commodore Levy. For Monticello, a new era had begun, an era of restoration. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.